From KCUR, I'm Steve Kraske, and this is Up to Date. Way back in 1981, when Ronald Reagan was president, politics simply worked, or at least that's what Chris Matthews says. His new book, Tip and the Gipper, When Politics Worked, chronicles the bipartisan efforts of President Reagan and then Speaker of the House Tip O'Neill as they worked through compromises that would shape America as we know it. We'll talk with Matthews about how Democrats and Republicans put down the boxing gloves to raise the debt ceiling and pass other important legislation back in 1981, and why they just can't seem to do the same now. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. Once upon a time, Republicans and Democrats in Washington knew when to fight and when to link arms. Turn the clock back to 1981. Republicans had balked the year before when President Jimmy Carter needed to raise the debt ceiling. Not a single GOP House member went along with Carter. A year later, a new president, Ronald Reagan, needed Democrats to back the increase. So he went to House Speaker Tip O'Neill, who said he'd oblige, but only if Reagan supplied a personal note for every Democratic House member requesting his support. That would provide cover for the Democrats against future opponents. The next day, 234 letters arrived. Hardball's Chris Matthews shares the anecdote in his new book, Tip and the Gipper, When Politics Worked. Chris Matthews once was a top aide to Tip O'Neill. He joins us now from his office at MSNBC in Washington. Chris Matthews, welcome back to Up to Date. So good to have you again.
Thank you, Steve.
So how did Tip O'Neill in 1981 get away with a plan to cooperate on the debt ceiling when Republicans just the year before, Chris, had rolled up on Jimmy Carter and refused to give him a single vote to raise the debt ceiling? I mean, you think that O'Neill's fellow Democrats would have revolted?
Well, no, because there was no gain for them in holding up the debt ceiling. What would be the gain? I still wonder about the current fight. What's to be gained in the end? You're going to have to raise the debt ceiling because you've already spent the money. This is merely making payment on what you owe for having spent it. So he didn't see any gain in that. I think there was also still at large the notion of a honeymoon, that if a president's elected, he has for several months the right to expect that he won't be sabotaged, that he will have a vote on what he needs to have a vote on. And so Tip extended that honeymoon idea to August 1st. He said, you will have an up or down vote on all your major proposals in the campaign by August 1. And he did. He had the tax cut vote. He had this domestic spending vote. And, of course, the Pentagon hike, all because those were the key issues Reagan had ran on. And Tip wanted to make sure that they had a vote on those so that he could, as he put it, put the monkey on the president's back and make him the incumbent as quickly as possible, so that he would take the responsibility for whatever direction the economy took. And that was his strategy. It was partially goodwill and partially canny politics.
But, Chris, what a concept. The Speaker of the House saying to the new president, we'll give you an up or down vote on all your stuff between now and August 1st. Let's let it rip. You ran on this stuff. We'll give you a vote.
Well, I think there was this sense of respecting the voter then. You don't have it today. I mean, I understand all the politics of gerrymandering, and I understand how politicians can say, I'm just representing the people that elected me. But there ought to be a decent respect for the opinion of mankind, as we said in the Declaration, a decent respect for the country's opinion. If the country, why would a member of Congress feel confident morally in simply saying, or he or she, I don't care what the rest of the country thinks. I don't care. I don't care if they elected Obama. No matter if they elected him or not, I'm going to behave the same way. Well, that's not the way self-government works. You generally meld together your own philosophy with the country, the electorate's decision-making, or else we'll never get anywhere. If people just every day act like we didn't have an election, it's going to get to be like the Middle East or in many third world countries when no matter how many elections they held, there are people that won't respect those elections and say their elections were rigged or something. And they never accept the legitimacy of the winner. And so they have nothing but turmoil and anger, almost tribalistic anger. Yeah. And here we have in this country something approaching that, where elections don't seem to matter.
I was going to say, what's changed? I mean, since when does this notion that a new president gets an up or down vote on his or maybe in the future his or her initiatives, why doesn't that still hold today?
Well, you know, I always get into trouble, and therefore I pull back from saying it's ethnic. But from the day that President Obama was elected, certainly from his inauguration on, there was a sense of we're going to jam this guy and we're going to make sure he doesn't get anything on the board. He doesn't score any points. He doesn't become a figure of achievement. And even now, as we approach these last couple of days of fighting over the debt ceiling, it seems to be about removing from the record books, if you will, his achievement in healthcare, undermining it in some way that hurts it fiscally so that it will be damaged.
And you think it's because of race, Chris?
I believe that the attitude about this president, the idea of succession, we're hearing those terms in the South, the rebel flag the other day at the White House, the statement by a Southern South Carolinian congressman who said, I felt sick having to stand within 10 feet of the guy. The birtherism, the endless. I had a member on Hardball a week or two ago, and I asked him, just repeat after me, this president was elected legitimately.
Yeah, I remember that.
Endlessly questioning his birth in this country and doing it in a way that clearly points to Africa, not to Canada, as in the case of Ted Cruz. Although these gentlemen have, if you accept the dishonest claim that he was born in Africa, even then he was born to an American mother. And therefore, he would be just as much eligible to run for president as Ted Cruz, which I believe is eligible because he doesn't have to be naturalized because he's natural born as a son of an American mother. But to constantly refer to that, it's clearly ethnic. They say he's from Africa.
Why do they keep doing that?
But if you can't always delve into the degrees to which it reflects his philosophy, his somewhat aloofness, I guess you'd have to say. But there's a real hatred of the guy, which is certainly showing up right now, which I don't think we've seen before in this country. This maybe back to Roosevelt. You hear they used to talk like this about Roosevelt.
And again, this notion that it might be race related. Do you think the media has sort of backed away from covering this for the story that it actually is, at least in your view, Chris?
Well, you know, when we hear terms, we hear references to this, they just keep popping up. Donald Trump is very comfortable talking about how the man is somehow a non-existent being, that nobody knew him in high school, therefore his whole history is somewhat confected. All going back to, why would you do this about him? Now, I say this in the context of history. When George Romney ran for president, his was an emigre family that had gone to Mexico to practice polygamy. So he was the product of an American family that had basically left the country for political reasons, religious reasons. No one made an issue of that when he ran for president. It never came up. And when John McCain was born in the Canal Zone, it never came up. Barry Goldwater was born in the territory of Arizona. Not the state. It hadn't become a state yet. No one raised these issues. Why now?
So what's changed? Because in one sense, Chris, you struggle with the idea that House Speaker John Boehner and President Obama, they don't have a relationship even remotely one that resembled what you chronicle here between Reagan and Tip O'Neill. Am I seeing that right? I mean, just how would you characterize the relationship between Boehner and Obama?
The president, President Reagan and Tip O'Neill, never minded being seen together, having fun together. There were so many tapes available on videotape now, thank God, that show them toasting each other at St. Patrick's Day parties, being at signing ceremonies together, being, for those occasions at least, publicly as pals. And I think that today you see nothing like that. You see a frown on the face of the speaker when he comes out of the White House. Never arm around arm like you see on the cover of my book.
Yeah.
And in that case, and almost a tribal distance, like we don't touch those people. I mean, you hear these things about people saying, I had to stand 10 feet from him. Or Charlie Crist, when he hugged him, the governor of Florida, whose career was ended basically by showing any kind of connection with him. And yet the public yearns for that. The most popular, and I think the only popular moment in the 2012 election was when Governor Christie of New Jersey walked along the beaches of New Jersey with President Obama together. And the people said, that's what we want. We want cooperation. We're almost like kids demanding that our parents show some affection for each other, some common interest with the family that you're raising.
And Christie was excoriated for it.
Yeah. The thing is, the thing I raise in the book, and I didn't know it was going to be in as hot a season that it came out, is that we're never going to have a one-party system in America. Those are rare moments when one party really has dictate, like with LBJ after the Kennedy assassination. And that lasted 2 years until we had the big inflation that cost him 50-some seats in 1950-66. Or the other even more unique situation of FDR in the first term. Those gentlemen quickly lost their mandate to rule as individuals. So we're always going to have a situation where one party has the presidency, maybe the House and Senate by a very narrow majority, but they can't get beat a filibuster, or they get one House and the other party has the other House. So we're always going to need, because the way you write a bill, both houses have to approve it and has to pass the Senate by 60 votes, and the president has to sign it. So solving that simultaneous equation is always going to require some degree of goodwill and bipartisan compromise. It's going to, or else we simply stall and keep floating backwards.
Hardball's Chris Matthews is our guest. His new book, Tip and the Gipper, When Politics Worked. You know, Chris, maybe the best story in this book, and the one that sort of summarizes exactly what you're talking about here. This happened even before Reagan took office. Tip O'Neill tells President-elect Reagan something about how the two should manage their relationship. And what did he tell Reagan about getting together after 6 o'clock? And how did the incoming president respond to that?
Well, apparently, well, and the first I heard of it until I read Tip's memoirs, and that's I hadn't heard of it when it was going on. Reagan, the president came to give the State of the Union address. And ironically, you might say the Speaker of the House's ceremonial office, which is right next to the House chamber, is his green room, his holding room. Mm-hmm. And he was, and I was his Speaker's AA, and I had this big desk outside that office. And I went in to say hello to the president, because I never had a problem with Reagan. I went in to say hello to him as a person, and I said, "Welcome to the room, Mr. President, where we plot against you," just sort of to break the ice. And Reagan was very quick to answer, "Oh, no, not after 6. The speaker says we're in Washington, we're all friends after 6. And so, and then I began to read about how Reagan would call him up at 3 or so in the afternoon and say, "Can we reset our watches for after 6? And I want to ask you to do something." But, you know, even when they weren't connecting politically, and that was rare, they were talking, and when the time came, they really did sign these arrangements, whether it was the 82 deal on raising taxes or the big Social Security salvation, really, in 1983, or the really good tax reform bill of 85, or the Northern Ireland Agreement, or really Tip backing Reagan up in the back room with Gorbachev before Reagan even met Gorbachev. He was there vouching for him. And then making sure the Democrats didn't cause any trouble when the president went to Geneva or later to Reykjavik. Tip really wanted the country to be united, and I think Reagan understood that.
In fact, Chris, at one point, Tip O'Neill is Ronald Reagan's envoy. I think it was to the Soviet Union.
Yeah.
You can't imagine a time now when John Boehner might be President Obama's envoy to a foreign nation.
He went over there in April of 85. And here's the interesting thing. I went back after writing the book, and I got our producer here came up with some archival footage of the Today Show, April 10th, 1985. And just think of the difference in the time zones. Bryant Gumbel, who was the anchor then, said, "In this hour, a bipartisan delegation is meeting in Moscow with the new Soviet leader. They're carrying with them a letter from President Reagan asking to meet with Mikhail Gorbachev. The leader of the delegation is House Speaker Thomas P. Tip O'Neill." Bryant announced that without any irony or novelty or exceptionalism. It was merely an American in the government representing another American, the president. The sense of unity was accepted and believed to be normal. That's what's changed.
Wow. Well, Chris, you're saying that the American people want that kind of cooperation again. They're not getting it. I guess the question becomes obvious. How do they get it? What needs to happen to bring that level of cooperation back into the system again?
Well, the important thing, I think, is to disaggregate your beliefs, which are valid, and you should go with your beliefs and your philosophy from your methods. Now, there's not much difference between Ronald Reagan and the average Tea Partier out there, maybe in degree, but not much. He had great mistrust for government. He wanted taxes lowered. He hated it when the government grew. And that was his belief. And he argued for it. And he used the regular system for fighting it. even though he was also a supply-sider. Tip O'Neill also had his beliefs. They were grounded in years, decades and decades of working with people with problems, older people, people with sicknesses, people in economic trouble, young people who couldn't afford tuition to go to school. And so it wasn't about differences in philosophy. I mean, Tip O'Neill and Nancy Pelosi are the same person politically, big city ethnic politicians. Mm-hmm. And Reagan is very much like probably someone to the right of Boehner, but pretty much a conservative Republican today. But the sense of extremism in terms of using the system, of being able, as we're doing right now, risking our credibility in the world. The one thing we've always had is the 100% safety record for investment in the United States treasury mm-hmm. bonds and bills and savings bonds. And whether you're a paper boy like I was investing in savings bonds or you're a Chinese billionaire, you always knew, even though it didn't pay the highest rate, that that bond or that bill was guaranteed.
Yeah.
There was no question about it. Like an airline that's 100% safety yep. record. That's being risked right now. And I think that the president in those days, Reagan, wouldn't have done it. I mean, they had those minor little fights over government shutdowns, which lasted 2 days. They were easily negotiated. They were not this profound challenge that's out there right now to the president, that unless he in some way undercuts his number one achievement in history, the health care bill, unless he's willing to undercut it in some way, they won't agree to a debt ceiling. Now, that's really almost a non-negotiable demand, I think. Yeah. For that, how could Obama accept that and still really be president? And I think they're basically threatening him with a choice: either humiliate yourself or destroy America's credibility. And I think that's a challenge that's really unreasonable.
And Chris, just briefly, so how would you, a listener out there who's agreeing with you and wants to see more cooperation, what should they do? What can the average citizen do to begin to turn the train around again?
Well, I think they have to not be totally extreme, or as extreme as some have become in terms of method. I mean, when I worked in the 70s for Senator Ed Muskie, we would have the budget agreed to by May 15th, mm-hmm. ahead mm-hmm. of the October 1st new year, fiscal year. We would have all the appropriations done on time. We would have a second budget resolution. This was all written up in the Budget Control Act of 74. We were following the rules. By the 1980s with Tip O'Neill, you had most of the appropriations bills finished, but then the CR was just there, the continuing resolution, just to cover the ones that weren't. But now you have no budget because Texas's Ted Cruz said, I don't want a budget. He prevented the meeting of the House and Senate budget committees to compromise on a budget. No appropriations bills passed. Government shut down October 1st because no work had been done. Hmm. And now we're up against a budget ceiling 48 hours away, and people are questioning that. There's no agreement on the importance of it. There are deniers out there now, and I think that's politically inspired. And why? what other reason would there be for saying you don't think the deficit or the debt wall is really facing us? There's no other reason to question it unless you've got a partisan reason for continuing to argue. I don't know. I think it's about watching your representative in Washington and asking them to be organized and responsive to the voter, and recognize that it's not all political warfare, total warfare like today.
Yeah. And where do you think this debt ceiling thing is going, Chris? You just pointed out Thursday's the magical deadline day. It's Tuesday right now. We're past noon Eastern time. Where's this thing going, at least in your estimation?
Well, we're watching the House right now, and they came in with a number of proposals, or you might call them obstacles, to a deal this morning. And now they're saying that they're considering some changes to that proposal. I just got the word here a minute. Somebody just passed this to me. So I guess we should watch between now and nightly news, I guess, tonight, how Boehner's able to move his caucus a bit closer to a deal. I think the Senate's agreed right now to a deal.
Boy, Chris Matthews is our guest. He's from Hardball. His latest book, Tip and the Gipper, When Politics Worked. Our phone number here, 816-235-2888. Again, 816-235-2888. You can also drop us an email to uptodate@kcur.org or tweet us @kcuruptodate. Let's go to Joe from Lenexa. Joe, you're on with Chris Matthews. Good morning.
Hi, Chris. I have three comments I'd like to make, and I will listen to your responses off the air. First off, this is the second time I think I've heard you on Steve's show, and I really enjoy you at times like this because you're speaking as an American and as a historian of American politics, as opposed to your persona on MSNBC that is all Democrats, 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 and bad things from Republicans. I think I understand why, but my second comment would be, I'd like you to talk a little bit, if you think the cooperation between Congress and the president would be better or would have been better over the last 6 years if Hillary had won the Democratic nomination instead of Mr. Obama and had become president. And my last comment would be, I think the actual degeneration between the respect between Congress and the American people and the president actually started under George W. Bush. I mean, it was the first time in my lifetime where I heard politicians actually referring to the president as Bush, like so many of them now say Obama. They don't say Mr. President or President Obama.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all I got. I will listen off the air. Thank you.
Yeah, I appreciate the phone call, Joe. Let's go with that Hillary Clinton question first, Chris Matthews. I mean, what would have happened if Hillary won? How would things be different? What do you think?
Well, I'm not sure that foreign policy would be proceeding the way it has with us withdrawing from Iraq and Afghanistan on a pretty steady course and avoiding getting involved in other Arab countries. I think, or an Arab country like Syria, I think she would be more, I think I would place her a couple notches to the right of the president on foreign policy and leave it at that. I think he's very much dovish. I don't think he's a pacifist. I think Jimmy Carter, when I look back, was a pacifist. He's definitely not. I can see that in his approach to terrorism. But I think he's dovish in terms of starting wars.
Mm-hmm.
Hillary's more aggressive that way. She just is. Her record shows that. As for relations with Congress, I think they could be better. I think that former Senator and Secretary Clinton was very good in the back room. I think she won a tremendous amount of respect from people like John McCain on the other side of the aisle. I think she's a real collegial person, more of a collegial person than Obama is. She just is. And not just because of her gender necessarily, although that may be more of a norm among women. They do work, my wife who's taught me this, are better at collegial work than men are. Men are more hierarchical, more John Wayne, who's the boss.
And you do get the impression,
Chris,
that Obama really struggles with that part of governing. Am I right?
I don't think he enjoys it. And I think that's a pretty fair statement. I don't think he enjoys what a lot of us would enjoy. I mean, being president would seem to be the real fun part of it would be to be the first among equals in a card game or a guy who's out up on the Hill, even or back at the White House weekday nights, inviting over some pals from the Hill and having a couple drinks and and talking over who's who and what's everybody up to and sort of enjoying that. He's very formal about it. He'll say, meet me at the Jefferson Hotel. There'll be 12 of you, and I'll be out of there by 9. You know, and you could argue that he's a better family man than most politicians. But, you know, it's a tricky business to accept being a family man full time when you're president of the United States. I don't know many that have accepted it that way. And he certainly must be with his family. I think my role in MSNBC is much more, I think it's more rambunctious than the viewer may like, although I think the viewer just called it does watch me. It's more more of a tumbler, which is a Yiddish expression for the guy up in the old borscht belt who would come on and on a rainy day keep the women excited. I mean, when nothing else was going on, it's too rainy. It was John McLaughlin, of all people, who first christened me that way. He said, you're a tumbler. I think that's my personality. I think I'm just more gung-ho on a program where I know what I'm doing. And I think sometimes it is adversarial. But I think in this whole fight, I'd be hard-pressed to be even-handed in the sense of blaming both sides equally for this current situation. I believe you could argue big spending. Certainly the Democrats have more than their role in that one. But in terms of this threatening of meeting the national debt and a possibility of default and the whole saga which began with Ted Cruz saying we're not going to have a budget agreement and then pushing for tying basically the death of health care with the government shutdown, the continuing resolution, I think that was a one-man war that was basically, it's like Charlie Wilson's war. I mean, he did that. He got the Red Hots in the House to go along with him. So if I say that and that sounds more partisan, I think it's not. It's an assessment that is accurate, but it does point the finger to one side, and I think it's true. I actually do think this is one time where the one side has caused the problem.
You know, our caller was raising this question about the lack of respect between Congress and the American people, Congress and the president, starting under George W. Bush. I'm just wondering about the role of TV shows like Hardball, so many shows that are out there like that that really do constantly stir the pot. How much culpability lies with shows like Hardball, Chris, when it comes to the nature of our natural of our national discourse these days?
Well, the true distinction of my show is not that I take sides, although I certainly do a lot, because I do believe in one point of view. But it's the but when it comes to procedure and the way people behave and what I do believe primarily in self-government, like most of us do. We want the system to work. But at my word, Hardball, it came from the book I wrote back in 88.
Right.
I think it means that I'm willing to say to a guest on my show, excuse me, sir, you didn't answer my question. I want the answer. And my willingness to go four times at somebody until it's clear that either they've answered the question, which they often don't, or that you can tell they didn't, that shows to some people a little too much push on my part. All I can tell you is that's the distinction of the show. I can't tell you how pathetic I think it is when someone goes on television and makes the most ridiculous statements and the person interviewing them goes to the next question, like they're robotic about it. My job's to push. Oh, yeah, well, that's a funny thing you just said then. Do you question the president's legitimacy? And I had a Texas congressman on 2 weeks ago who said he wouldn't repeat after me. He was legitimately elected. Well, that to me goes to ethnicity. It goes to a man's belief there's something wrong with this guy's background. He's from Africa. Or else, why wouldn't he just say, of course he was legitimately elected?
Yeah. Chris Matthews is our guest. His latest book, Tip and the Gipper, When Politics Worked. We're going to take a break now. When we come back, we'll talk with Chris about a jobs bill back in the mid-80s and how Tip and the Gipper worked that one out. Also, get your phone calls here from Kate, Tom, and Larry. And we'll get a phone call from Bob. 816-235-2888 is our phone number here. Our email address, UpToDate. At KCUR.org. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. This hour, we have the pleasure of visiting with Hardball's Chris Matthews, his new book, Tip and the Gipper, When Politics Worked. The timing of this book, Chris, was just impeccable given all the stuff going on in Washington, D.C. these days. Our phone number, 816-235-2888. Our email address, UpToDate@KCUR.org. Chris, let's turn to another example from deep inside this book. Again, Tip and the Gipper, When Politics Worked. And it concerns the need for a job bill because the country's unemployment rate at that time was the highest since before World War II. Set the scene for us here, Chris, because the president took a quick trip to Boston at Tip O'Neill's backyard, where he showed up in a pub to drink with a crew of workers in plaid shirts. That led to a showdown with Tip O'Neill in the White House. Why did Reagan go to Boston to begin with, Chris?
Well, I think to show he's a regular guy. And, and all those years, especially in 80 when he ran for president successfully, he really had appealed to the what became known as the Reagan Democrats. Those were people who, the Irish, Italian, Jewish, whatever, they had grown up as Democrats, but they were really dismayed by Carter's weakness. So they were ready to go, and Reagan plucked them. He was the Gipper. He was the hero of Notre Dame, the great Notre Dame movie. And he played that card, I thought, brilliantly, going to the Statue of Liberty and really grabbing the patriotic feeling of so many people, like myself, in fact, yourself probably. I mean, it's just he did it so well. And then they what he did, though, is he made some comment after he'd been to the Erie pub. He started talking about maybe we should just get rid of this corporate tax. And he had just meeting with some high tech executives. And he got off on it. He said, I know I'll pay for this. I'll kick myself for doing this. But I think we should maybe get rid of that corporate tax. Well, Tip, of course, said that's your game. That's the way you've been playing politics. You're with the rich guys, the big businesses. But they got back to the White House and they started to talk. And then I had another one of those Donnybrooks between the two of them. And it sort of ended with Reagan and not going along with Tip about a spending bill, a jobs creation bill, an infrastructure bill. And then Reagan did something really remarkable. He sort of went after Tip at another meeting in the White House, meeting over in the state dining room where Reagan was about to meet with a lot of the committee chairs, introducing his budget for the year. And he took Tip aside and he said, you know, Dave Stockman, the budget director, says we're not as far apart as we thought we were. I think we can get something together here. And that was a very, almost a high school. We had a little fight and let's be friends. By the way, that happens so often. And then they agreed. And then Stockman showed up at the speaker's office right before he got married that weekend, and they cut a deal, and they did something for the jobs bill that Reagan had been against all along. So I thought it was wonderful to show that the president would be humble enough, president of the United States, to basically chase after a guy and say, no, I think we can be friends on this. I think we can get something done here.
What was interesting to me about that story was just how intensely the two had sort of gone after each other, on a very much of a professional basis in the days leading up to that. And, Chris, I just love this part of the book. On the night that this deal sort of culminates, in his diary, March 17th, Ronald Reagan writes this, which happens to be St. Patrick's Day. He writes this: Tip is a true pal. He can really like you personally and be a friend while politically trying to beat your head in. I mean,
that's my favorite too.
That summarizes this book pretty well, doesn't it? I mean, that's it, right? In one sentence.
Mike Deaver described the birthday party that Reagan hosted for Tip at the end of the first year. And Reagan didn't drink hard at all. He worried about the Irish curse, you know. And I grew up with that in our family.
Yeah.
And I think he was worried, but he didn't drink much. But just to honor the occasion, he at one point said, bring in the champagne, like in a movie. And they brought in some champagne for toast. And he offered this over-the-top toast to the speaker, saying, if I had a ticket to heaven and you didn't have one, I'd go to hell with you. I mean, it was totally ridiculous, over-the-top. But, you know, Tip left apparently very feeling just incredible warmth. They arm in arm walked to the elevator. And as Mike Deaver said, and then Tip went outside and kicked the hell out of Reagan in front of the reporters. So Tip would say that was normal politics, that you could have two parts to your personality. One, which was the reasonable, friendly, cordial guy with the other side. And the other one was to go out and publicly be the adversary. And Reagan accepted that. He would say to his friends whenever Tip took a shot at him, he'd say, oh, that's just Tip. Let it go. It's just Tip being Tip, you know.
Let's go to Sarah from Harrisonville, who wants to make a point about the fact they were both Irish. Sarah, good morning.
Hi, yes. I think that nobody in Congress seems to feel ethnically connected to Obama.
Yeah.
I don't understand. I think he seems like a charming, intelligent fella, but he's not. Maybe he's not funny enough. I don't know. But Tip
he's not funny enough.
Could be.
Maybe you're right.
No.
Ronald Reagan and Tip O'Neill were both Irish. So ethnically, they were connected no matter what. So I think that, you know, it's. I'm sorry that nobody understands Obama and nobody wants to get along with him in Congress, but I don't know what you can do about it. I feel very frustrated by it.
Yeah,
I don't know. I think President Obama is an amazing American. I think his ability to, if you look at his team, it's almost colorblind in terms of the positions he fills people with. And his ability to, because he had a white mother, I guess I wouldn't put him in a simple category ethnically. I find him to be, he had a lost father. He only knew for hard, I'm sure he doesn't remember him. And a mother and a white pair of grandparents who raised him, basically. So it's such a fascinating thing to live right on that color line and be, anybody's from a mixed background knows what I'm talking about. And I don't know what it feels like to be able to feel the same kind of kinship and to marry an African-American woman who is a real African-American woman. She didn't come from a mixed background, and she's beautiful, but very, you know, in appearance, terribly, wonderfully, gorgeously, if you will, African-American, and yet he would date white women in college, apparently, or something. I mean, his ability to sort of choose who he is is really profound, and it's something that's almost wondrous in America, where you can sort of choose who you are going to be with. His friends are obviously a lot of African-American guys back in Chicago, but also he has all these close relationships, and you can see how close they are. But like, you know, it just seems remarkable to be that kind of a good American. But his real problem isn't that he doesn't connect in terms of identity politics. It's that he is basically not interested in seeing the presidency as a collegial pastime. I don't think he does see it that way.
Let's go to Kate from Overland Park. Kate, you're on with Hardball's Chris Matthews. Our phone number again, 816-235-2888. Kate, go ahead. Good morning.
Hi, Steve. Hi, Chris. Thanks for taking my call. I was really interested in what you said about separating the beliefs from the method. And I saw something floating around the internet lately about a rule that was changed in the House that no one could bring a vote to the floor now except for the Speaker. Is that a new thing? Is that something that, with the liberal side of thing, that was changed just so that we could keep the shutdown happening or whatever? But that just seems like a crazy method to employ to change the fundamental rules of how the Congress operates.
What about the new
rule,
Chris?
I don't know that because I know that you can issue it. You can bring a discharge petition, which brings a bill out of committee and to the floor by getting like 217 votes now. I know that works. I also know that when we lost a vote over the procedure back in late spring of 81, where the minority leader, Bob Michael, was able to put together his proposal. So generally you control the House Rules Committee if you're Speaker. That means you can decide what comes to the floor through the Rules Committee. And if someone tries to move for something on the special calendar, it takes 2/3 to pass it. So I don't understand if there is such a rule. Maybe there is, but I think you can still get a measure to the floor by either the procedure of discharge or the defeating a rule on the floor.
Okay, let's go back to some calls. And Leanne from Kansas City, Missouri. Leanne, good morning.
Good morning. I'm interested in the fact that approximately a year ago, there was an editorial in the New York Times concerning the comparison with President Obama and the Jim Crow laws that were acted in the South when they saw that suddenly they did not want to have ex-slave legislators and people running things that they had just had in slavery. And I believe that there is a lot of racism, and why do people continually call it Obamacare, which is okay, but they tend to do that with a derisive effect like the Republicans do instead of just saying affordable care. And that's all I have to say.
Yeah, I think also what they get away with, his adversaries, is to call it a bill. Now, Jim DeMint of the Heritage Foundation was a senator for a while, and he ought to know the difference. It's an act.
Yeah, it's law.
It's an act of Congress. It's a law of the land. You can't keep calling it a bill. The trouble with Obamacare, and I know he relinquished that, allowed that to come, relented to that. The problem with that is it makes it his baby. It is his baby. It's something he will always have on his scoreboard for having achieved. But it's the Congress. It's the Democrats. The Democratic Party should take credit for that because they basically got it through. All the Democrats.
Yeah.
And I think Affordable Care is not a very exciting title for a bill. I have to say they could have come up with a better name than that. But Affordable Care.
Yeah.
I can't think of anything more boring, but it is a useful title, I guess. But Obamacare does have a certain derision to it. There is no doubt about it. By the way, in the voice of some people, the word Obama is basically spoken with derision. And I really do think it has to do with what he looks like. To most of us, he's just an attractive, young, well-educated guy with an incredible IQ, a bit aloof, who's had an incredible political trajectory that makes you wonder if he isn't truly charmed.
Yeah.
Because some things seem to break in his direction, which you can never foresee, like the Syrian thing where we're actually having inspectors over there for chemical weapons without a shot being fired by us. And you wonder how that happened.
Yeah.
So I think he is a lucky guy. We'll see if this week proves that true or not.
Hardball's Chris Matthews is our guest. His new book, Tip and the Gipper, When Politics Worked. You know, Chris, you begin the book, you talk about your journey on Capitol Hill. How did you wind up working for Tip O'Neill to begin with?
I was in the Peace Corps in Africa. I was working, speaking Zulu, and driving around with a Suzuki 120 motorcycle and motorbike, and I out in the middle of nowhere. And I worked my way home. I went to Israel for a month, lived in the old city right above it, and spent some time in London, ran out of money, came back to Washington, went to Chapel Hill where I was at grad school, said hello to my friends, came back to Washington and began knocking on doors. And I finally got a job working at night as a Capitol policeman. I didn't have any connections. And then working during the daytime for Senator Frank Moss of Utah. Then he recommended me to Senator Muskie. I got the Budget Committee, which is a really good job, which was just starting. And then I ended up at the White House. An old girlfriend actually told me about an opportunity when Carter was elected, and I got in the door there. And then I became one of the president's speechwriters. And then I was called by somebody who was one of our researchers at the White House, at the Democratic Committee, who is now working for the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee in the House. And he brought me aboard with his boss, Tony Coelho of California, approving me. And I came aboard to sort of help Tip O'Neill further exploit the fact that he was the last Democrat standing.
Mm-hmm.
And after 3 or 4 months working for him behind the scenes, his top guy left and he gave me the job.
What was he like?
I mean, you could call it serendipity, but I always, sometimes when I talk about this, I feel like I was zealot. I was always there, you know.
What was he like to work with, Tip O'Neill, Chris?
Tough, very tough.
Really? How?
Well, as Kirk O'Donnell, his chief of staff and sort of the first among us equals, was that you had about 1,000. If anything didn't go wrong, it was your fault. He had won 50 elections in primaries, and he just thought if something went wrong, somebody had to pay for it. It was a very tough standard, and I was pushing him to do television, pushing him to become a real challenger to Reagan, and sometimes it didn't work. But my belief was people, once they got used to him and figured out who he was, didn't really like him. And I was right. He ended up with 67% in the Harris poll for job approval. I mean, he was liked because people realized that even if they disagreed with him, they knew he was telling what he thought was the truth.
Mm-hmm.
And he cared about people. And even though he's an old-time big-spending liberal, they got, you know, he was the real thing. And I think that today we don't know what's inside some of our leaders. Even Boehner, we can't quite figure out. And even the president at times. Who is this guy? Who's Harry Reid? Mm-hmm. Who's Mitch McConnell? We don't know what drives them except partisanship in some cases, and that's not very attractive. If all you're known as is a partisan Democrat or partisan Republican, that's not enough. You got to be seen as being for the country and for people that need help, and then they'll begin to love you even if they think that's all true.
You know, back in those days, either you or somebody on your staff got Tip O'Neill on an episode of Cheers.
It wasn't me. It was one of
right.
It was the secretary worked for him. Had a son working as the casting director for Cheers, and he did it as a favor, but it turned out to be great for him because there he is in that great poster that you can get in a lot of poster stores, sitting to the right of George Wendt at the bar where George always said, the post guy always sat at the end with his like pointing his finger, look who's here. And I got to go back and watch that. I'm sure it's on YouTube. But he was so natural. I said he was like the foam on. You know, in a Sam Adams. I mean, he just looked like the guy would come into a bar and get a beer.
What did Tip O'Neill say about Ronald Reagan, even behind the scenes when the media wasn't around?
Oh, God, I just spoke before I finally turned the book in to all four of his kids. My God, that's the hardest. I can handle the Reagan side because Ron Reagan, who's a friend of mine, told me that Reagan was very fond of Tip and he said so around the house. So that's taken care of. On the other side, Susan O'Neill told me that they were real friends. Tommy said they were frenemies, meaning they would argue, but they were friendly. Rosemary, who's the oldest one and the most serious, said, I can't tell you. I can't figure it out. And Kip is the skeptical one. He thought they were just rivals. So, you know, I that's where it stands. That's my Supreme Court, the O'Neill family. My view is that I didn't know the relationship as much as I've discovered there was to it. I've seen the film. I've seen the meetings. I've seen the parties I didn't get to go to. I've seen Reagan's and studied Reagan's diary with these wonderful quotes like you just mentioned.
Right.
And I've gotten the inside much more than I actually noticed. I found out about how Tip behaved himself when Reagan was in the hospital for being shot and how he kneeled down and kissed him and recited the 23rd Psalm together. The Lord is my shepherd. And these two old guys being so close like that, you know, he never came back and told us about that, you know. So a lot of it was just research and reporting on my part. It made me think I was wrong, and it wasn't just political rivalry. There was something deeper there and many more levels to it.
That's a beautiful thing you just said about the two of them sort of heads together reciting that psalm. What a great image, Chris.
Isn't it good for the country to do that?
Yeah,
I'm glad I found out that from Max Friedersdorf, who was Reagan's chief of congressional relations, who was the only other guy in the room, and he told me about it. Yeah.
Let me go to Larry from Lenexa. Larry, you're on with Chris Matthews from Hardball. Good morning.
Oh, good morning. Yeah, I just listening, I had a couple of quick comments. Somewhere along the line, President Obama did say he kind of liked the term Obamacare. It might have been off the cuff, but even though it may have gained a derogatory
right
tack to it. He did acknowledge it at one point, and I think Mr. Matthews did refer to that. But the thing I'm curious about through this debt ceiling thing, and the thing that no one seems to mention concerns me the most, is the thing that we mess with the most is this thing called the reserve currency. And the fact that we are the reserve currency in the world, and the amount of power that gives us over the world economy. And it seems to me that the losing of, you know, getting, we're on the edge of paying bills, yada, yada. But if we get to the point where Russia and China and Brazil can get away our reserve currency, we're in big, 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 big trouble, in my opinion.
That's what I've tried. Yeah, I do, because I've been thinking about that so much. I was thinking, for people that don't know much about this, and I don't know much about international currency and all that and how it's done with the reserve, but we do know it's a fact. It's the dollar is the basis of all international value. And increasingly, it's used as currency. I mean, many countries now are using it as their currency. If there was an airline that had a big sign at the airport that said 95% safety record, well, you'd look around for one that was 100%, wouldn't you? Mm-hmm. Because you got to get on that plane.
Mm-hmm.
And for 100 years, people have found us. They found us. We're the one with the 100% safety record. That's why the Chinese billionaire, who may not like us or even care about us, puts his money in U.S. paper. It's why the paper boy, whoever was working as a teenager like I was, you're told to buy the savings bond, though even if it won't pay the most, it's guaranteed it's as strong as the U.S. government. What happens when we lose that? This is horrific. We have our self-government, and we value it, but we also value our faith and credit. We value the fact that we are trusted in the world, in a world that's filled with nonsense and craziness and third world and fourth world nuttiness and adversarial relations, then it's the one place in the world you can put a buck and know you're going to get some interest on it.
Yeah.
It's the only thing in the world. You can't be sure of gold. You can't be sure of anything. But that you can be assured of. You make your deal, the government stands by it. Why are we screwing around with that, around this little stuff around Obamacare? It is disproportionate. It is so disproportionate to get a little bit of shot at Obamacare. They're risking that, the treasure we have in the world that the caller just mentioned. You don't risk that. It's not grown up. And I really do think it verges on the criminal. I'm not pointing fingers at any one person. But the fact that these two sides in Congress haven't been able, including the president, three sides, to get this thing way behind them months ago. When they should have said, this is coming, we have to fight it now. Let's decide now to have these debates. Set our own deadline for when we're going to stop arguing. Don't let the world deadline drag us down. Why don't we just say, okay, let's make a decision by June 1st how we're going to deal with the end of the next debt ceiling. And just be grown-ups about it and honor the deadline. What would stop them from doing that? Okay, I'm getting emotional, but I mean this. It really bothers me that these people don't serve us well.
Chris Matthews is our guest. We're talking about his latest book, Tip and the Gipper, When Politics Work. You know, Chris, I need to get you on something else here, because the last time you were on our show, you were here to talk about your book on John Kennedy.
Yeah.
You've written a couple of books on him. One was your most recent bestseller, Jack Kennedy, Elusive Hero. The other one was Kennedy and Nixon, The Rivalry That Shaped Post-War America. You know, obviously, we're approaching the 50th anniversary of Kennedy's assassination, and I just saw the movie Parkland and was moved by it. Yeah, it was good. I really was moved by it for lots of reasons.
All that blood. We never think about it as wound, as an actual. To us, it's so iconic. We don't think of it that physical way.
No, you don't. And the way they sort of manhandled the casket up the steps to Air Force One that day, and all those moments that just sort of come back to you. And I'm wondering what your thoughts are about that moment 50 years ago and how the world might have been different if that event had never occurred.
Well, Steve, the way I was able to write a book about Jack Kennedy was by blinding myself on purpose to the way he ended. It was the only way I could write it, was to just close my eyes to Dallas and talk about his life right up until that moment. I wanted to show and celebrate who he was and what he was able to do in leading this country, the first president on civil rights. And there's all these areas where he was just the one that did it. And I think that was, to me, the great story I wanted to tell. But there's no doubt that the effect that his death had on us was so powerful that it's never left me. I can always go back in my mind to just November 22nd, 1963. I was up at Holy Cross College up in Massachusetts, and I was there. And I was checking my mail, and some guy said to me, did you hear Kennedy was just shot? And I went over to my world history class, and the professor let us out of the class, and I went back to the basement of one of the dormitories and watched Walter Cronkite for the rest of the weekend. There is no doubt that anybody who was through that will never get it past them, because we lost the young man we picked as our president. We lost him. He was just taken from us by an assassin. And the ceremony of his funeral was just beyond beauty. It was it was Irish.
You know,
it's Gothic nature. And we've never gotten past the horse or how beautiful Jackie was and sad and the kids and Haile Selassie and De Gaulle. It was just, there has never been a painting as beautiful as that. And yet, it was about the end of something that just could never come back.
You call him, I remember that you told me this a couple of years ago, you call Kennedy a far greater hero than he ever wished us to know. You meant what by that?
With all his misbehavior, and it was there, I didn't write about it much, but it was there, the man was in almost constant pain from the time he was a kid. He was left alone in boarding school with his mother never visiting him, thinking certainly scarlet fever, then leukemia. He was having his blood count taken all the time. He thought he was going to die as a teenager. And then all the back injury that never got cured. Pain most of his life. He couldn't pick up a golf club. He couldn't pick up John or Carolyn. Couldn't pick them up. And he was always wearing that back brace that in the end kept him from crouching down in that car. You know, it's just a story. He was a World War II guy, like Tom Brokaw described those guys. They never complain.
Yeah. Chris, always a pleasure. All the best to you, Chris. Thanks so much.
You
bet. All the best. Chris Matthews is host of MSNBC's Hardball. His new book is Tipping the Gipper: When Politics Work. Tomorrow on the show, former Talk of the Nation host Neil Conan joins us. Plus, we'll talk with a grandmother campaigning against gun violence. Our show is produced by Steven Steigman, Danny Alexander, Beth Lipoff, and Cody Newell. For KCUR, I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.